Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya, your host, joining you from India. And we are talking about prostate cancer this evening on our 88th episode. Our prostate cancer talks are conducted in association with Prostate Cancer International and Prostate Cancer Foundation. For men, the consequences of prostate cancer are often less to do with life and death and more to do with an altered way of looking at certain aspects of their lives and coming to terms with that. There are ramifications of prostate cancer treatment on male psychology due to loss of sexual function, incontinence, and other factors. We are discussing changes and challenges in life after prostate cancer with a very distinguished guest, Dr. Anne Katz. Dr. Anne is a certified sexuality counselor at Cancer Care Manitoba and clinical nurse specialist at the Manitoba Prostate Cancer Center. In these roles, she counsels men and women with a history of cancer who are experiencing sexual and relationship challenges. She also supports couples through recurrence and treatment decisions at that point. She is a fertility preservation counselor for the organization and also runs a sexual rehabilitation program for women and after radiation therapy. Welcome to Cure Talks, Dr. Katz.
Thank you, Priya.
My co-host for the show is Mike Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, a prostate cancer-specific, not-for-profit educational and informational organization based in Virginia. Mike works for Calcium, a privately held healthcare communications company based in Philadelphia. He's also a member of the board of directors of the National Organization for Rare Diseases and the International Myeloma Foundation. Supporting Dr. Katz and Mike on the panel are experienced and knowledgeable prostate cancer survivors and advocates, Tony Crispino, Bill Martin, and Fei Funk. I extend a hearty welcome to the panelists and to all our listeners. I would like to remind our listeners that you can mail your questions to priya@trilex.com or press 1 on your keypads and we will bring you on air to ask them. With that, I now hand over to Mike to begin with the discussion. Mike, you're on.
Thank you, Priya. Good evening, Dr. Katz. Thank you for joining us this evening.
You're welcome, Mike. Nice to hear your voice.
I actually saw you briefly at ASCO the other day, but you were traveling too fast and I couldn't catch you. Perhaps we could first sort of 15 minutes or so, and you could talk to us a little bit about your experience in talking to men at the time they get diagnosed and also to their wives and, where relevant, other family members. I know you wrote what I consider to be a very salutary article on that topic a while back in ASCO Connection, and perhaps you could just review some of the things you try to make sure men understand when they do get diagnosed.
Sure. I think at the time of any cancer diagnosis, the number one thought for the individual plus their family members is, am I going to die? You know, is this person that I love going to die? And for the most part, prostate cancer, particularly now in what we call the PSA era, so since the 1980s when the PSA screening has been really popular, we see men who are diagnosed with early localized disease. We do see men diagnosed with more advanced disease, but the vast majority are diagnosed with early localized disease. But, you know, we're still saying those words, you have cancer, and after hearing those words, everything changes for the man and his family. What follows is really a time of great turmoil and distress for the man and his family, and it's absolutely imperative, I believe, that men get assistance with treatment decision-making. This is a process where generally a healthcare provider who is specialized in understanding not only the treatments for prostate cancer, but also the consequences for that man for the rest of his life. The vast majority of men diagnosed with early localized prostate cancer are going to die of something else. They just don't know this at the time when they hear you have cancer. And when we treat these men generally with radical prostatectomy or radiation, we create lifelong problems for them in the areas of bladder control and sexual dysfunction. So as a result of surgery, we see men really lose their ability to have erections, sometimes permanently. And with radiation, we generally see the onset of erectile problems generally 1 to 2 years after the radiation therapy. So we treat the cancer, we essentially cure the cancer for many, many men, but they're left with ongoing problems that fundamentally affect their quality of life. And men really do need to understand this. Not infrequently, I hear men and all their partners saying, you know, sex doesn't matter. We'll, you know, I just want him to, you know, be around to, you know, mow the grass and be my partner and be the father to our children and the grandfather to our grandchildren. And that's really an initial response where people think that this is a sex or death decision that has to be made. And reality, and this is what I wrote about in the ASCO blog, this isn't about sex or death. Really, I think this is about a treatment decision that's going to affect the man and his partner for the rest of their lives together.
And do you get the impression that most men and their spouses really grasp this when you talk to them about it? I mean, I hear a lot of men and spouses after treatment, and it only seems to be then that they start to really grasp what's happened.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think this is part of the problem, that in that chaos and turmoil of diagnosis, they'll do anything. So one of the things that I do is I tend to see men, well, I ask to see men about a week after they've heard the diagnosis, because I find by then the dust has really settled. And while in many areas of cancer treatment, the focus really is on getting treatment quickly, about the only gift of being diagnosed with early localized prostate cancer is that you do have the gift of time to investigate the treatment options, talk about what the consequences are going to be, because all the treatments, surgery, radiation, are essentially equivocal or equal in terms of their effectiveness. They just have different side effect profiles. So take the time to really read, perhaps talk to other men, but you have to be a little bit careful about that. I find that very often men, even if they're experiencing side effects, tend to try and persuade other men to have the same treatment that they had. I call it the misery loves company theory. I'm not quite sure why it happens, and I'd love to study that one day. So you know, read, speak to healthcare providers, get a second opinion, get a third opinion, until you're really absolutely sure that you've understood the information. I think it's very difficult to ask men to imagine what life might be like with poor bladder control. I think it's a very difficult thing to ask people. I think it's very difficult to ask men to think about what life might be like without spontaneous, reliable, rigid erections. They just can't imagine that for the most part. I think sometimes there's also magical thinking. I speak to a lot of men and I say to them, well, okay, so what are your erections like now? And they say, well, you know, I'm in my 60s. They're certainly not what they were when I was in my 20s. In fact, they're not even what they were when I was in my 50s. And somehow, you know, they think that the treatment is not going to affect the quality of their erections. Of course it is. So these are really difficult decisions that have to be made. But they have to be made. And one of the things that I really want these men to avoid is treatment regret. So that feeling of, you know, I shouldn't have, if I'd known X, Y, and Z, I would have made a different decision. So I am brutally honest with the men that I counsel. I think sometimes they get way more than they expected, but there's no point in me sugarcoating the reality of what life may be like after treatment.
And that raises a very interesting question, because one of the things we hear all the time, and of course one's not in the room, so it's impossible to know, is that men when, particularly here in America, where usually they do not see anybody other than the person who's going to treat them, they feel that they were not appropriately advised of the potential consequences of the treatment. I mean, I'm not trying to point fingers here. I know people don't also don't hear things that they're told.
Right. So,
but I have a theory that, in fact, when people like you who have no interest in the actual treatment have this conversation, it is a different conversation than the conversation they have with a doctor.
I absolutely agree with you, and that's one of the reasons why I have the position that I have was created at the Manitoba Prostate Center. We know that after someone hears the words, you have cancer, they hear about 10% of what they're told. So it is quite possible that they really aren't not only hearing, but understanding, synthesizing what they're told. That's absolutely a possibility. I think the other issue, and I'm also really not pointing fingers at any one particular discipline or specialty, but if a urologist who does surgery doesn't believe that what he or she is doing is the optimal treatment, I think you've got a problem. So I think there is sometimes, a selling job that this is the correct treatment, and men don't even realize that they have other options, which I think is disturbing. So, when you're looking for a second opinion, don't go see another urologist. Go and see a radiation oncologist. If you first see a radiation oncologist, go and see a urologist. Read widely. If there's a prostate cancer support group near where you live, attend a meeting or two and speak to other people. We know from studies that men do tend to take the treatment of the person who diagnosed them with prostate cancer. And then, often decisional regret ensues, which really is a pity.
Have your conversations changed significantly since active surveillance or active monitoring or whatever you want to call it has at least become accepted again, as opposed to everybody thinking that you had to take out every piece of cancer that anybody had?
It absolutely has changed. As we get more and more information about really the criteria for active surveillance, I think we're able to speak with a little more perhaps certainty. We know that men with low-volume Gleason 6 disease are ideal candidates for active surveillance. And for me, it's really important to use the correct terminology. So when patients come to me and say, my doctor said that I could also go for watchful waiting, I explain to them, because I think language is important, that what we do now is active surveillance, which is actively monitoring the status of the cancer. I get the same thing for men who are prescribed androgen deprivation therapy. They come and they say, well, I'm taking hormone therapy or I'm taking hormones. And I point out to them, no, we're giving you androgen deprivation therapy, because the implication of hormone therapy is that they're actually taking hormones, and in fact we're doing the exact opposite. So yes, active surveillance, I think in some jurisdictions, is becoming more acceptable, but not in all. And, I think the mighty dollar sometimes plays a part in that as well. Physicians are not paid the same for active surveillance as they are for surgery or radiation.
And is your position in Canada unusual, or are there people like you in many Canadian provinces who actually provide this service as a part of the prostate cancer diagnosis experience?
Really, I think the only other center that I know where there are people doing similar work is in Vancouver, but it really isn't available. And, often men actually go to their primary care provider, their nurse practitioner or internist or family physician, and they say, what would you do, doc? I think that's a really unfair question, because the physician or nurse practitioner or physician assistant, to answer that question is, once again, hypothetical, and until you're walking in that man's shoes, you don't know what it's like. Men often say to me, what would you do? And, I can give them a glib answer. Hey, I don't have a prostate, so I can't know what I would do. Then they turn around and they say, well, what would you tell your husband to do? And my answer is, I wouldn't tell my husband to do anything because he has to live in his body afterward. You know, I would certainly explore all the options, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote my book for the partners of men with prostate cancer, and it's called Prostate Cancer and the Man You Love. So it's for men and women who are partnered with men diagnosed with prostate cancer, because the partner plays an important role in supporting the man and often in actually finding that health information and really helping them make that decision. I don't think a partner can make a decision for a man.
One of the things that was very interesting that I think, you know, sort of ties into this, when they were doing the PROSPECT trial in the UK, they discovered that until they got the doctors out of the way of helping the men to decide whether they wanted to participate in the trial or not, they were having very poor enrollment. Once they transferred that to knowledgeable nurses, they became very successful at enrolling patients. And it seems to me that there is a real communication problem here that is probably not completely specific to prostate cancer, but it seems to have a particular level of importance in men's understanding of what their options are when they're diagnosed with prostate cancer. Do you find that by comparison with diagnoses of other cancers, or would that be a misleading idea?
I don't know. I mean, I think one of the unique things about prostate cancer is that element for most men of treatment choice. There are not many other cancers where those choices exist. You know, for breast cancer, really it's the mastectomy versus lumpectomy and radiation decision. And even there, it's not... We know that for early breast cancer, lumpectomy and radiation is as effective in treating the cancer as mastectomy with much less morbidity or side effects. So I think really prostate cancer is quite unique. And I think the other way that it is so unique is that the side effects affect a fundamental aspect of men's lives, their self-image, their masculine self-image, you know, their erectile functioning, which is really, in many instances, central to a man's view of himself.
So that's kind of interesting, and we have Bill Martin on the line, who I know was actually a patient who you talked to originally. But Bill still had, a considerable period of time before he was able to come to terms with all of the consequences. Bill, do you have questions for Dr. Katz?
I was Dr. Katz's patient, and she answered all of the questions in a very consistent way. Now, would I ask? I suppose if I had to do it over again, I would have had a second biopsy because my Gleason score was 8, and as it turned out, it was the lower of the 2 7s. I don't know, Anne, how you get men to talk about this. I was scared silly, in panic, and thought I was doing okay, but I didn't. I wasn't able to, for instance, ask my surgeon how many times had he done this. You know, what result did he have? Was there anybody else in Winnipeg who was better than him or in Canada? Did he keep track of how he did? Those kinds of things.
Bill, you raise a really important point. So sometimes men say to me, how many surgeries has Dr. A done? And I say, you can ask him or her. And often, they sort of talk about high-volume surgeons being better. I'm not sure that that's 100% accurate. A bad surgeon can be a bad surgeon no matter how many surgeries he performs. I think that we have oversold this idea of nerve sparing. I think we present that to men in a very black and white way, or men understand it in a very black and white way because they are desperate for it to work. In reality, this whole nerve-sparing issue, frankly, I think is a little bit of a crapshoot. Works for some, doesn't work for others, and that, you know, and that's problematic. Men are upset. They say, I went to this guy because he does nerve sparing, and you know, look what's happened. There are urologists certainly who are older who didn't learn nerve sparing techniques as part of their training. You know, who kind of figured it out long after. The younger urologists should have learned this as the standard way to do the surgery. But even then, there are so many factors. You know, it's first of all, the nerves are not visible to the naked eye. They do not look like the yellow electrical cords that we see depicted in diagrams in the patient education materials. You can't see them. Yes, they run with blood vessels, but the kind of traction and that happens in the area can put those nerves into shock, which then starts a whole cascade of events that the end result of which is no erections. I think sometimes men also they're not particularly proactive in trying to get things going again. They're kind of hoping that things will get better by themselves, and that's not always the case. However, it is for other men. You know, and there are some men who do really well. You've always got to bring the brain into it. So I think male sexuality is far more complex than we generally give it credit for. We see male sexuality as an on or off switch. That's not the case at all. Men have hopes and fears and dreams. They're concerned about their partner's sexual satisfaction. And so often, you know, their brain gets engaged to the detriment of their penis, and they're concerned, you know, is it going to get rigid enough? Is it going to last long enough? Am I going to be able to do this? Am I going to be able to do that? And poop, you know, away goes any hope of an erection because they get performance anxiety. And it's difficult to quiet that little voice in the head.
And when you have spouses there or partners there as well as the patient, are there particular things you try to make sure that they understand?
Absolutely. So the first thing that, you know, spouses tend to say is, I just want him to live. I don't care about sex. And 3 months later, 6 months later, that couple shows up, and now sex is really important. You know, and I understand that. So I ask the partner, you know, to really think about the meaning of the sexual relationship within that couple. Let me give you an example. Some years ago, I saw a couple who fought every single day. One or the other picked an argument, right? And it was a fairly conflicted relationship. They had a knock down, drag them out fight every single day. Why? Because at night they made up. This man has a prostatectomy. He no longer can have an erection. So, you know, sort of their usual sexual activity was not happening, and yet they were still fighting every single day. They were a couple in trouble because they had no way now to make up. So that meaning of sexual activity in the relationship is important to consider. So that's one of the things that I ask the partner to think about. And also really to impress upon them that this isn't a sex or death decision. And I sometimes feel like a broken record. I have to keep reminding people, right, this is not the choice you're making. The choice you're making is one around quality of life.
We have another panelist on with us, Faye Funk, who married her current husband, after he'd had surgery for prostate cancer. But Faye, I'm wondering whether there are questions that, you know, you would have thought you'd like to ask Dr. Katz if you'd been there at the time or subsequently.
Well, I think for myself specifically in our relationship, the communication has been so open and so loving and supportive ever since I came into his life and learned about this. And what I've been learning since talking with women and partners on the website is that you're right, the communication is not there. And Dr. Katz, what can other doctors do to encourage the patients to bring their partners in from day one? Because you'd be surprised, or maybe not, how many people I've spoke to that are not, their husbands do not want them going to the doctor appointment. How can we overcome that?
Yeah, so thank you, Faye, for raising the C word, communication. You know, I believe that no matter what the sexual problem, communication is at the root of finding a solution in terms of talking with a healthcare provider, getting a referral for help, and for the couple to talk. I tell patients categorically that they need to bring their partner in because four ears are better than two. It's important to have that other person there, perhaps taking notes or just listening intently, because one or both of you are going to have that white noise, you know, that cancer noise going through your head, which gets in the way of understanding, hearing, understanding, and synthesizing. I occasionally see a man, not very often, because we really do encourage men to bring their partners with them. In fact, when we send out appointments, so I'll get a referral letter to see someone and we send the appointment out. It says, you know, in uppercase letters on the appointment, please bring your partner with you to this appointment. But you know, occasionally I have seen a man who comes in without his partner. And one of my opening statements is, so, sir, you're alone here today? And sometimes they'll say, yes, I'm single. Or they'll say, my wife's at work, or, you know, my partner couldn't make it today. And there actually have been occasions where I've given the man brief information and then I've said, it's not fair to do this without your partner. It's not fair to you. It's not fair to your partner. You need to bring him or her in. And generally they will come back with their partner once they understand the importance of this. I do not understand any healthcare provider who does not want the man to bring their partner in. The partner is an ally in so many ways. And we know that, well, I think any cancer is a couple's issue, but particularly this one because of the sexual consequences. And
right.
I'm glad, I say, I'm so glad, you know, I'm so glad that you found love in this way. It's, you know, it's a blessing.
It definitely is. Thank you.
So, we also have Tony Crispino on the line, who is a patient advocate and works with the Southwest Oncology Group and other groups and runs a support group in Las Vegas. Tony, are we doing enough research in this area at all?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we're currently working with the NCI in developing not in so much as a clinical trial base, but a survey to get on out there and understand a little bit better about some of the emotions involved in survivorship. I think that one of the keys is, you know, for each of the surgeons / doctors, and we'll even go with the medical oncologists who deliver hormonal therapies, is understanding the individual, just like Dr. Katz had just indicated. And that would bring me to a question to Dr. Katz. You've mentioned briefly the single man. I just had one walk in the door over at our support group the other day, and he's going it alone. He has still got a dating life. He still has the desire to go ahead and marry. He has nobody right now with which he's really closely connected to that is going to get him over the threshold, if you will. But for these guys, understanding the difference between sex and intimacy, or how to proceed after this and then be able to get back on the horse and get out dating again. What do you say to those guys?
Yeah, you know, it's really difficult, and I think these men are really at a disadvantage in terms of lacking that primary support. You know, once again, I think it's about communication. I do some work and have just actually written two books for and about young adults with cancer who are often single. And, you know, the issue of dating after cancer is a huge one because it requires disclosure of something that is private and scary And when rejection happens, it just adds another layer to the individual's vulnerability, right? Did a second mm-hmm. date not happen because of me or because of the cancer? So, you know, I think everybody has to find a level of comfort around disclosure. And a lot of people actually choose to disclose right up front early so that there's no, you know, implication that there was not complete honesty and transparency. The other thing that I point out to men is, in fact, I saw a single man the other day. He was a guy in his late 60s. And this was his issue, right? How am I ever going to find someone? So I said, you know, okay, so what age group, you know, from which age group are you interested in dating? And he looked at me like I was a little crazy, and he said, well, someone like my own age. So I said, do you think it's possible that this man happened to be heterosexual, that any woman your age doesn't perhaps have some of her own issues? You know, perhaps some body image issues, perhaps some postmenopausal stuff. Is that possible? And he just burst out laughing. You know, I think he in his brain was imagining, you know, a scenario where he would potentially find someone with no baggage, with no problems. As you get older, stuff happens, and, you know, we have baggage around that. Our breasts aren't where they used to be. We've got cellulite and scars of our own. And we're not perfect and are afraid of being or nervous about being judged as not perfect. So, you know, we all come, particularly in the fourth, fifth, and sixth decade and beyond, we all come with issues. And being vulnerable is difficult.
I have another question about the ramifications of particularly, I think, more often surgery than radiation, but it probably happens with radiation too. And that is the situation where initially after treatment, the relationship seems fine. But gradually thereafter, the man starts to withdraw as he discovers that he really doesn't have the capacities that he had before. And I frequently am speaking with women who, you know, feel that they, you know, that their spouse or husband has literally withdrawn completely into a, you know, basic couch potato who they have no relationship with anymore. Do you have particular advice when this sort of thing happens? Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, so, you know, I think there can be a number of issues. It's interesting that you said sort of couch potato. So is there an element of depression here? I think that's, you know, important to identify. If the man's being a couch potato and not doing anything and socially withdrawing, you know, what's the issue? If he's having issue with incontinence, you know, it might be that he's embarrassed, afraid to go out in case he has an accident. And, you know, the one thing about incontinence is that it's public as opposed to sexual problems, which really are private and nobody needs to know about. But if a man's had an accident, you know, people know about it. So what I commonly see with couples is this scenario. They're past what we call sexual script. So their way of being sexual with each other involved, you know, initiation at some point, sometimes earlier in the day, sometimes later in the day. So there, and each couple sort of has their way of initiating. So it might be communication, hey, are you up for it tonight? It might be something nonverbal, you know, perhaps he's more, he's touching her more, whatever. He stops doing that because in their sexual script, that was the beginning of the initiation. And he doesn't do it anymore because he doesn't want her to think that something is going to happen later because he can no longer have an erection. The partner may stop touching the man because the last time he or she did that, the man interpreted this as the invitation or the initiation of something. And because he couldn't follow through, and I'm making little air quotation marks here that you can't see, that because he couldn't follow through, he got very upset. So the partner stops touching the man because he or she doesn't want that upset to happen again. The net result is a couple who don't touch each other, who are living as college roommates and who are lonely, so lonely, because as human beings we need touch. We fundamentally need touch. So, you know, I talk to people about this. I say to them, you need to have a conversation with each other around what touch means now in the aftermath of treatment. That it doesn't necessarily mean an initiation. It could just be comfort or skin hunger, right, that need to be touched. But you've got to talk about it, because what worked before does not work in the new context of life after prostate cancer.
Okay,
or any other cancer for that matter.
Hey, Tony, Bill, would you like to chip in on that? I mean, obviously you've got more experience of this than I have.
Oof. I guess it's not so much a question as just screwing up your courage to figure out what you want, and then screwing up even more courage to get that to your partner. I found it incredibly difficult. The old dance, we had a seductive dance, and it worked well for years and years and years. And all of a sudden, that was gone. I had an implant in my penis, so I could have an erection whenever I wanted, but I still wanted more and didn't know how to get it or how to ask for it. And I guess if Anne had any thoughts about that, that'd be a lot of interest to me.
Well, you know, I think you've really hit the nail on the head here, is that we're human beings and we have the gift of speech, but because things have been automatic, spontaneous, reliable, easy, many of us have never talked about it, you know, in adult words, using our outside voices. We've communicated in grunts and squeaks and facial expressions, and over time, you know, you learn what those mean. And now, lo and behold, you know, that language is gone because you know, the context has changed, and you have to ask for what you want. And you have to open your mouth and your heart, both of you, right, to talk mm-hmm. about what this means. And it's scary and it's difficult because you've never done it before.
I got to relate back to my deal with this. It started at the age of 44 with prostate cancer surgery. I believe that there is a pretty large difference between the younger man and the older man in this particular arena, because 44 years old, when we were engaging in this, there were still thoughts of even having maybe another child or so forth along that.
Mm-hmm.
This can
mm-hmm.
be a little bit of a different concept when coming on out of it, and with my case, going straight into hormone therapy after surgery. The younger guy and the wanting to continue the family, what would you say to them?
Yeah, you know, I've actually seen men, and sometimes it's actually men into their 50s and 60s. So one of the things that I will ask, you know, and when they bring their spouse or partner in, it's a little bit helpful. You know, if I see a woman who's obviously in her 60s, I'm not that much concerned about having kids. But I sometimes have this little spidey sense, right? And I say, hey, are you – and I say it in a kind of lighthearted manner, because I think sometimes a little bit of gentle humor helps with sensitive topics. And I say, hey, are you done making babies? And every now and then I get a little surprise when the man says – or the partner says, well, actually, no, we're thinking about adding to our family or, you know. So then, of course, we talk about – sperm banking immediately, and luckily men have the time to do it, or they need to get busy pretty darn quickly, which obviously doesn't always work, because you know it's about the timing that needs to be right. I think things are qualitatively different to younger men, but honestly, in the big scheme of things, you know, men are men, and this is about pleasure and comfort and male identity, and is really important. I have some patients in their 70s and 80s who are still, you know, actively seeking to have erections. Sometimes it's because they're widowed, and there's my understanding, because I've been told this, is that in order to attract anybody, even in a nursing home, you have to have an erection. It sounds a little bit like high school to me, but apparently the women in these places are talking about men who can't have an erection, and that's not a good thing. I think it's incredibly cruel on any level, but this has certainly been the perception of some of the older men that I see. I think obviously, adding to your family or creating a family adds an additional level of complexity. That question needs to be asked, particularly of younger men.
So, in terms of the whole question of male identity, I think this is a very important part of the whole thing, and it is often something that men themselves, although they know deeply that something about their sex life is incredibly important to them, they don't necessarily really understand why. How do you talk to men about that?
I actually think the fact that I'm a woman is an advantage. I have never had a man, after I've spoken to him, say to me, that was not helpful, you don't understand where I'm coming from. Because I'm a woman, I do not make any assumptions about where the man is coming from, what he thinks or feels. I have to ask those questions, which I think sometimes other men don't ask. Right? Because they know how they feel, so they kind of transfer that to the man with cancer. I ask questions, and I warn men, I'm going to ask you lots of questions, and some of them, may seem invasive, but there's a reason. I'm not just, doing this to be voyeuristic. So I ask those questions. Can you imagine? What might it feel like? What is happening? Is the issue that you can have an erection standing up but not lying down? How rigid is it? On a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being when you were 17, 0 being, nothing at all. Show me. No, I don't mean show me your penis, not at all. That would not be good. And I actually sort of, use my index finger sort of going from curled up to, standing straight up. Tell me what is going on. And then also, the values, beliefs, and attitudes of that man and that couple are really important. Is this a couple who are mentally flexible and creative in terms of their sexual script? Those are the couples that manage to create something after treatment. For couples who have a very rigid, ritualized way of being sexual, Saturday night, 10:20, in the dark, missionary position, jammies on, those couples often really flounder because they can't figure out a way to do things differently.
Well, and I always feel that men, not only do men not know how to talk about this to women, they don't know how to talk about it to men. It's something so deeply, private about it that we just aren't good at having those conversations at all.
Well, I think in part because you're socialized to joke about it.
Right.
So men joke about it all the time.
Oh,
but
sure.
That's not
a conversation.
Exactly. But that's the only way you know how to talk about it. I think the other thing is that it really is about kind of an alpha male kind of thing. I think it is very difficult for a man to admit to another man that he is not able to have an erection. Because I think somewhere in the reptilian part of our brains, that is interpreted as that man is weak. I don't believe that for a nanosecond, right? Because, men and women, we are far more than our sexual organs. But I think, that's a very primal kind of instinct, and I think that gets in the way of meaningful conversations often. Perhaps it's just easier for men to actually talk to a woman because, my reptilian brain doesn't respond to that at all. Get me talking to another woman about body image, and it might be a little bit different. But I'm not a man, right? So
I'd
don't
like to
project.
Speak to that, Mike, if I may.
Sure.
before I had the surgery and after I had the surgery, I went to a prostate support group and I wanted to talk about impotence. And actually nobody did. The women looked interested in the group and the men didn't say much. And that was my experience for quite a while. Then after a number of years and I'd written about it and I'd spoken about my experience and in painful detail told how depressed and unhappy and difficult I was, and had my book handy so they could look at it, then it was amazing how many men started to talk. You know, once I told my story really explicitly, it was amazing. All sorts of questions came out, and I think men need another man to come clean before they can come clean.
If I could say something to that as well, Mike,
sure.
This is Faye. We've experienced that firsthand, Keith and I. Keith has put himself out there and really has told his story and has been very graphic with other men when they reach out to him and want his story. And as soon as he does that, then everyone's guard comes down. Mm-hmm. And he's shared some of the emails that he writes and shares with other men, and it's quite amazing to see their openness and how they just put themselves out there and make themselves extremely vulnerable. But I do think it takes the man who's gone through this, I think they need to make the first step to say, this is what I went through, this is what I have experienced, I'm here for you.
And would that make sense to you, Dr. Katz?
Oh, absolutely. I think, though, that it really does take a special kind of man who is willing to open up and be that vulnerable, because I think men are socialized, right, to be big and strong and not to admit to these kind of vulnerabilities. So, you know, the world is a better place for the Bills and Faye, sorry, I just already forgot your partner's name.
Keith.
We need more men we need more men to be open about it. It will really help.
So I think this has been a great conversation. What I'd like to do now is hand it back to Priya, because we may have some people online who'd like to ask questions, and we've got another 13 minutes or so. So, Priya, if I hand this back to you, do we have any questions from people online?
Thank you, Mike. I've been receiving some questions via email. Dr. Katz, I'll just quickly go through them.
Sure.
Just the latest one says, Dr. Katz, could you please speak about the cases where the doctors tend to favor the radical perineal prostatectomy, which is more likely to leave the patient with erectile dysfunction, over the retropubic approach?
So here in Canada, and in fact I think in North America, the perineal approach has really fallen out of favor for reasons really outside of the erectile problems that it causes. One of the problems with doing the radical prostatectomy that way is that they can't do adequate examination of the lymph nodes and extraction of the lymph nodes. So in North America, I don't believe that approach is even taught to residents anymore. I don't, certainly where I live, there is no one who does that, and to the best of my knowledge, that really has fallen out of favor. The retropubic approach also causes erectile problems, as you've heard, you know, certainly Bill talk about on this call.
Thank you, Dr. Katz. The next question, Haynes writes in saying he had TURP procedure for BPH and has a PSA of 5.4, and this was in 2009. And he's been taking Lupron for quite some time. So he wants to know, do you have any input on how to deal with current problems due to Lupron? And if there are any suggestions for help medically, holistically for side effects? He's a very active 80-year-old man, and having met a lady friend would be nice to have desire and ability for an active sex life.
Yeah, so I'm really not going to speak to the indication for the Lupron.
Yeah.
Lupron is one of a class of medications that stops the body's production of testosterone, which has profound impact on sexual desire and erections, particularly when men are older, and certainly someone in their 80s would be regarded as older. There really is very little that can be done while the man is still on the medication. Certainly that loss of desire, is very difficult to do anything about that. I sometimes find that men who have no desire are more accepting of their loss of erections, and that's about 85% of men on these medications actually lose desire. The 10 or 15% of men who still keep their desire are often extremely, extremely frustrated by the lack of erections. So it's an unfortunate position to be in. But there really is no medication to treat that or pretty much the other side effects of those medications.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is from a person who says, I have been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and I have been evaluating my treatment options and came across a procedure called MRI guide laser ablation. He says, it seems to me that these ablations would be considered preventive procedure, but not having to remove one's prostate radically. And he says, personally, I would like to retain my organs for as long as possible and maintain a higher quality of life for as long as possible. He's not asked the question, it's just,
So we don't. Laser ablation is really not an approved treatment for prostate cancer. It's approved for the treatment of BPH or benign prostatic hypertrophy. One of the issues with prostate cancer is that it tends not to be what we call multifocal. So there tends to be little bits of prostate cancer scattered throughout the prostate. So when that happens, it's very difficult to eradicate the prostate the cancer completely. That's really why the radiation is aimed at the whole prostate and the surgery takes the whole gland out. There's certainly great interest in these what we call focal therapies, but that the treatment that this man is considering is really not the gold standard of treatment for prostate cancer.
Yes, if I may, I think it's worth noting that there are several different types of focal therapy that are being investigated at the moment, but they are all either experimental or investigational. And they should probably only be done in the context of a clinical trial if at all possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, Mike. I'd agree with you.
Doctor, I think that's all that we have from our listeners today. Dr. Katz, would you like to give a message to our listeners regarding emotional aspect of prostate cancer in life after treatment?
I think the importance of communication cannot be underestimated, and that includes communicating with healthcare providers. I've often seen doctors walk into rooms and say, you're doing fine, aren't you? And it's very difficult to say, well, actually, I'm not. So open communication with healthcare providers and asking for the help that you need or want, and certainly open communication with your partner. Let them in. Let them help you or try to find a solution together to the problem. No man involved in a relationship is going to fix this problem by himself. It really does affect the couple and needs to be dealt with on that level.
So
thank you, Dr. Katz.
I really appreciate your
listening.
Time today. And thank you to the panel, Priya.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mike, Tony, Bill, and Faye. Thank you for your participation. The talk is recorded, and where the talk and the transcript will be made available on CureTalks website. Please visit curetalks.com for details on upcoming talks. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.